Hey, Portland. We'll be talking to novelist Caroline Levitt on Between the Covers today. But first, a quick reminder that it's KBOO's end of the year membership drive. While you're listening, head over to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. If you'd like to become a KBOO member right now, it only takes a minute. That's kboo.fm/give. Help us reach our end of the year membership drive goal of $70,000.
Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host this week, Avi Marr.
Caroline Levitt is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of 9 novels, including her latest, Days of Wonder, out in April of 2024. Many of her titles have been optioned for film, translated into different languages, and condensed in magazines. Many of her titles were Best Books of the Year and Indie Next Picks. A New York Foundation of the Arts Fellow, she was also shortlisted for the Maine Reader's Prize and was a Goldenberg Fiction Prize winner. Days of Wonder made the Amazon pre-order bestseller list, clocking in at number 48. Welcome to Between the Covers, or I should say welcome back to Between the Covers, Caroline Levitt with your new book, Days of Wonder.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So what was your inspiration for Days of Wonder?
The inspiration was I was actually at lunch with a friend of mine, and she was talking about a friend she had, saying, oh, you would love each other. And I'm always interested in meeting new people. So I said, yeah, I'd like to meet her. So I met this woman, spoke to her on the phone a couple of times, really, really liked her. But it wasn't until after about 3 months that I had known her that my friend said, look, I promise never to reveal her identity, so I won't hear. But my friend said, look, this woman said I can tell you the truth now. She was arrested when she was 15 for murder, which she did do, and she was in prison. She was in prison for about 5 years, I believe. And when she was let out early, she totally transformed herself, created a new identity, became successful, and she was fine until she was in her 40s. And then somebody found out and she was outed, and she lost friends, she lost jobs, it was truly terrible for her. And she kept saying, like, when do I get to be forgiven ever? And I kept thinking about that, thinking, like, that's a really interesting question, because she's the most wonderful woman, and I didn't want to write her exact story because I wanted to protect her. So my friend said, look, think of a different story and, you know, just go ahead and write it. And she said, if you want, you can ask this woman, but it was a sensitive topic. So I didn't want to hurt her. And I promised my friend I would never reveal who she was. And I changed it so it became just not just one person, but two people. A boy and a girl, sort of a Romeo and Juliet sort of story, where, you know, the boy, they're both 15. The boy's father is this prestigious Superior Court judge. He's got a lot of money. The girl is, like, she lives in Bay Ridge, Queens, and she, her mom is a single mom who was booted out of her Hasidic Orthodox Jewish community when she was 17 for getting pregnant. So the media had sort of a field day about this, and it was an attempted murder. It wasn't an actual murder, but the media had a field day with it. And the boy, of course, was let go because of his dad, and the boy vanished, and the girl was sent to prison. And as soon as she got to prison, she realized she was pregnant. And since she had been sentenced to 25 years, she figured, I should just give this child up, which she did. And when they found out that her case was sort of botched, they let her out early when her child would only have been 6. So when she got out, she was, like my friend, determined to create a brand new identity for herself, try to find her lost boyfriend, try to find her lost child, and really to recreate herself and have a new identity and earn forgiveness. And the more I wrote it, the more consumed I was by the story and about what would happen.
Well, your initial question is so great, because it doesn't really have an answer. You know, this woman's question about, you know, when can I go beyond this event where she was a kid and did do this action? I mean, one of the things that your book brings up so beautifully in looking at that is, how well do we know someone?
Right.
Right. Like her mother, Helen, just think of it from, you gave it all these different perspectives of how would you know if your child is capable, or are we just all capable?
Right. Right.
And you bring in lots and lots of really great things that sort of build to an understanding why, if, and what, and we'll, you know, I won't let anything out, but you know, it's very gray anyway in your book.
Yeah.
But it was one of these lovely questions about how well do we actually know
what we're capable of?
Know what they would do, and we know what they wouldn't do. We're so sure.
We are so sure. Plus, when you're 15, you know, anybody at 15 is like a runaway car. You don't have, your frontal lobe is not fully developed. I mean, when I was 15, I thought it was a really good idea to hitchhike by myself out of Boston at night. And I had planned to run away with my boyfriend to California, you know, with no money. And you see it and you think, well, that's a reasonable thing at that time. And, you know, Leslie Van Houten, the last of the Manson people who committed a murder. Well, she didn't commit a murder. She was actually in the car with the Mansons when they committed the murder. She was high on LSD. She was rightfully put in prison, even though she was, in her teens. She's now, I forget how old she is now, but she must be in her 70s maybe. While she was in prison, she taught other prisoners, she became religious, she became spiritual, and they kept denying her parole. And I thought about it and I thought, how is she a danger to society anymore? Like, when do you determine that it's okay that she can come out and live her life and continue to do good? And it was a question that bothered me. And the other question that bothered me is the whole thing about, I spoke to a lot of lawyers and judges, and they all say that when you're in an interrogation room and they go on and on for hour and hour, you just want the questions to stop. And it's something like 65% of all confessions are coerced. The person is just, you know, they just want the questions to stop, and so they tell you. So the whole question of who is guilty and of what and how you can redeem yourself is a big one. It's a big one.
So the multiple points of view around the one event that's sort of at the center of it moves so smoothly between what Jude remembers or doesn't remember or builds up to it, and what Ella thinks was going on and what Helen knew and didn't know. Do you like to write mostly in close third to get at everybody's interior life?
I do. When I first became a writer, I really liked first person because I thought, oh, that's the most intimate. But then as I got a little better at writing, I began to think, I want to know what everybody's thinking. You know, I always want to know when I meet new people, what was your childhood like? What were you thinking? What was the most surprising thing you did? So I really love to get into every single person's point of view. I mean, if there's a dog in the book, I want to get in the dog's point of view too. And it's, the problem with that though, is that it's really hard to know when to go in one person's point of view and how to keep the story moving. So I went to my old friend, the Post-its, and I had Post-its all over my floor, a different color for every character. So because I couldn't have Jude, the boy, have an answer before Ella, the girl, did, and I couldn't have the mother know. And if the mother knew something, I had to figure out, well, how is that going to reverberate with them? It was really, really hard to do, but I like to do it because I feel like I know them really, really well, and I can recognize them on the street.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a variety of parent-child questions that you move across in the entire book. It's one of my favorite parts of it. Is there are so many, I mean, the two parent-child relationships are so different. Like the function of the romantic relationship is such a refuge for Jude, and
yes,
and then Ella's jealous of her mom, and it's so complicated. So I was wondering, like, which of those kind of dynamics was most interesting to you? Because you do such a great deep dive into them.
Thank you. They're all interesting to me. I mean, I had a really strange childhood. I loved my mother, but my mother could be difficult because she was so unhappily married. My sister was my best friend until she turned 17, and then some emotional things started to happen with her. But I was basically the black sheep of the family. I mean, I never felt heard. I was always afraid to speak out. And by the time I left home, my thoughts were, I'm never getting married, and I'm never having children. I'm just never doing either of those things. And then, surprise, I fell in love, and falling in love, I wanted to have a child, and I started thinking really deeply about, well, how do I do this? I mean, how do you mother when you haven't had someone you think has been a good mother to you? Or how do you father when you don't know how to? And there was all this information coming at me about what I should do as a mother. And my husband and I sat down and discussed stuff, just like Jude does. We wrote down, well, we're never going to hit our kid. We're never going to yell at him. We're not going to do this. And it was all stuff that our parents did. And then we tried to think of stuff that we would do. So it was all interesting to me because I guess parts of it always were like me. I mean, I was not beaten as a child the way Jude was, but I was yelled at a lot. And it was the same kind of feeling that Jude, I know that feeling. So I knew how to write about it with Jude, that you could love your parent because sometimes the parent was nice to you, but at the same time, you wanted to make yourself as small as possible. And I understood what was going on with Ella's mother, where it was sort of us against the world, which was what my mother wanted to do. But my mother also really, really wanted to be a part of any relationship I had, which was weird. You know,
it's like, that was inspiration with Ellen and Jude.
Yeah, I didn't want, and my mother had that with my sister. She would always talk to my sister's boyfriends, and they were like family to her. She would have them stay over the house and whatever else. And I always thought that was strange. And so I wanted to, it was all interesting to me to write about because it felt like, well, I'm writing about my family in some ways.
One of the things I found fascinating was Helen's, even though she was kicked out of the Hasidic community, her, how much she longed for and missed that community, which was so sexist and so sort of didn't treat her well, but she felt so lonely without them. And so that idea of her mother not really being a role model, but really being a role model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the whole thing about the Hasidic thing was really from my mom, who had grown up one of eight kids. Her father was an Orthodox rabbi, and she used to talk all the time about how wonderful it was. There was always people there in community. And when you live in an Orthodox community, you sort of, everything is done for you. You sort of know your place, you know everything else. And my mother left the community when her father died. She just stopped believing in God, but she never stopped talking about what it was like to grow up or yearning for that. So when I did my research and I talked to a lot of people who had grown up Hasidic, which is a little more than just Orthodox. Yeah. And, you know, some of them would like be going on and railing and saying, this was terrible. I lost my kids. This was cruel. This was horrible. And I would always ask them, but is there anything you miss about being in the community? Mm. And they would all get quiet and say, yeah, you know, there was a sense of community. You felt protected. And I thought, well, that's the thing I'm always yearning for, you know, I have my own community of writers and I have my family, but isn't that what everybody wants, you know, to feel? And it's unfortunate that some of these people, there is a cost to that and a price to having that. But there are people who don't mind the price, who are perfectly fine about, you know, having to marry at 17 and having to dress a certain way or whatever else, because they just love the feeling of being embraced by this community. And, you know, it's a difficult thing to think about and to balance.
Well, that kind of certainty, I think, it seemed like Helen didn't want to leave. She wanted to be in that certainty.
Right.
But it was one of the things I loved about the book was how it was a book that really undid her.
Yeah.
Certainty in the Community was a true, you know, a book that she found and read. And then she's, because I think part of the certainty, that certainty with the community, and this is what's going to happen next, and this is what'll happen next. It's all you know.
It is all you know. It is all you know. And it's kind of like, you know, there's a price for knowledge. You know, there's always a price for knowledge, and you have to decide, are you going to embrace the uncertainty, yeah, or are you going to sort of combine it in some way? I always hope that Helen would be able to combine it. And I think she was on the road to doing that because she still lights candles.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. If you enjoy Between the Covers interviews and our other programs, please donate to KBOO. Now, during our end of the year campaign, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of KBOO donors. Thanks as always for your support. It's one of the things that I love, that watching Helen have to sort of grow herself up by herself.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, no spoilers, how she ended up so far on the pendulum on the other side, raising Ella.
Yeah.
That was pretty amazing. That was pretty amazing. So, I mean, each of your characters has such a wide arc.
Thank you.
I love that one.
Thank you. I love them too.
I can tell that you did, and that you did.
I do. I love them.
Yeah. So my next question was about secrets. The book is all about secrets.
Yeah.
Knowing someone without knowing, sort of a defining event in their history. And when both Helen and Ella had new people come into their lives, one of the things I loved about the book is it really brought up the question of, can they just have a new life and let that be behind them?
Like, right.
Like, do you have to tell every secret? I had never sat with that question before. Like, how did that sit for you when you were writing it?
I have the same. I'm so glad you said that, because that actually, I thought a lot about that. And I was thinking, you know, there's a scene where Helen spills a secret and everything collapses. And I thought, it's hard to hold secrets, but whose secret is it? Because any secret you hold really impacts all the people around you. And the problem with secrets is the more you keep them, there's always a moment where you slip and someone will catch you and say, but you said, you know, da 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 da, or I found out this, or why are you lying? I mean, it's I don't know. It's always a question of, like, what secrets do you keep and who do you keep them from? I mean, I have my son is in his 20s, and there are things that, I mean, I guess if he asked, I would tell him, but there are things where I feel like, why does he need to know that? He doesn't need to know that. Like, not even after I'm dead, he really doesn't need to know that. Mm-hmm. But there were secrets of my mother's that she told me later about, you know, affairs she had because she was so unhappily married. And I remember thinking, I would have been so glad to hear that, because I really didn't like my father very much. And I knew she was unhappy.
What do you like about if you had heard that? That you would
have because preferred- my father was a brute. My father was really horrible. He never spoke. He was always silent. He used to come home and scream and then go into the other room. And he was racist and, you know, and just awful, awful, awful. And he used to yell at my mother and humiliate her in public. And they tried to keep away from each other. And I knew my mother was really unhappy because my mother actually told me, which is another thing that, is it right to tell a 12-year-old girl? I didn't feel great about that. And my mother involved me in that. So when she did tell me when I was 17, which again, you know, was it right to tell a 17-year-old girl? Probably not, that she had had affairs and she was so unhappy. And that was kind of a secret where I felt, you know, on the one hand, I was glad to know that she was looking out for herself. But on the other hand, I was furious that she was telling me because she involved me in the secret. And what was I supposed to do about it? I was 17. I wanted to go off to college and have my own life and not be involved in that family life anymore.
Well, I think you're bringing up a good point about, to tie it back to the book, and go back to what you said earlier, your secrets become burdens to other people.
Yes. Yeah. They do.
That's a really good point. Like that, that's an awful story of how you had to, now I'm carrying somebody else's secret, and it's never, right. You should never put your child in that position. And so 12 or 17, I don't know, you know, I don't have an opinion on which.
They were both terrible. I mean, it was a bit exactly. Terrible thing because I always felt ill-equipped to deal with that. You know, it's not like I could sit down and say, well, in my experience, because I had no experience.
But it also makes me sympathize with Helen and her sort of drunken, like,
yes,
that's right. I think what you're pointing to, which is really lovely, is how painful it was for her holding on to somebody else's secret.
Yeah. Yeah. And she had no one to tell it to. So it was just building and building. I mean, I think a lot of the times, I think that's why I became a writer. So I could fashion my secrets into fiction and tell them. It's true.
I remember someone asked Pam Houston, do you know this quote? How much of your fiction is based on autobiography? And she said 67% or something, just as a joke. But like, yeah, duh, that's what we're all doing, you know?
Yeah, that's what we're all doing. It comes out whether you want it to or not. And that's why it's always so interesting. That's why I love talking to you, because you always bring these things out. And I say, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what I was doing. I didn't even realize it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but another layer of what you're saying about secrecy is that, can you get close to a person, but not include your secret in that? Because, you know, Helen and Mouse and Ella and Henry, I was really like, one of the things that I didn't know I had so much suspense about was like, it doesn't mean you don't get to be loved if you keep it to yourself on the one hand, or are you betraying someone by not telling them? I don't know. You really left it so open.
I don't know. I guess it depends if you're okay with your secret, or is that secret going to hurt the person if you tell them? Will there be consequences? Like if my mom told my father she had affairs with somebody else, she would. I guess it's the reason for telling him. She wouldn't tell him to be closer, she would tell him to say, screw you, I have this other life. And also, if she told him, I guess he probably would be hurt, but then he would take it out on her, and he might take it out on my sister and I. So I guess it depends why you're doing it. If you want to be really close to somebody, and it's not going to really hurt them, like, you know, I don't know.
That's the number one example I've seen in sort of the world of psychotherapy is people really fall into two camps, because telling someone about an affair, if it's over, it's just going to hurt the person. So
it's just going to hurt the person, right?
Some people say, why would you hurt your partner? It's not going to make you closer. And then there's another camp that says you can't have a secret between the two of you and really be close. And so there's both groups.
I wouldn't want to hurt somebody. I mean, that would be my main thing. Like, what would be the purpose of telling your partner? I mean,
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, unless your partner was also having affairs and you had a relationship where you both felt that was all right. It's sort of like a secret isn't just one person's secret. That's the problem.
That's a really good point. But if you ask the person who is having a secret kept from them, I think they
right.
Answer. But the other thing I think you're bringing up, which is part of the emotional dynamic, is if you have a lie, if you've told a lie, you have to live in a paranoid space where you have to watch over it, like you were saying, because you're probably going to have to tell another one to cover that one.
Right, right. That's right.
You live in a kind of a tension that I think sometimes blurting is really just to get out of it.
It's because of the tension. It's like you can't, I keep it. That's why even people who are confessing and saying, no, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. If they are guilty, sooner or later, they blurt it out, because keeping a secret is so hard. It's almost a relief to say, yes, I did it. Yes, I did it. So it's something I think about all the time. I mean, that's why I entrust all my secrets to my books.
Well, I mean, in fiction, I was thinking about this too. We know there's a secret, we know something bad's going to happen.
Right. That's right.
It's either going to explode or it's going to corrode.
Yeah.
Going to relieve. But in the book, I really wondered, especially with Helen and Mouse in particular, especially because in most ways it wasn't her secret.
It wasn't. It was her daughter's secret.
Doesn't need to be said between those two for them to be happy together. That was the one that grabbed.
And she had loved, but plus she had lied to him. I mean, he had asked about her daughter, and she said, "Oh, you know, you'll meet her." But so it was sort of like, I guess it wasn't really a lie, but it was a lie by omission. She didn't
tell him,
and she avoided the topic, and that's always bad to do too.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. It's a really interesting thing. And it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so connected to that is the other theme I really, coming back around to the beginning, is forgiving ourselves. Right. Like, is that the key to moving forward? I mean, staying with secrets, because I think your book was so beautifully held close, like secrets were not revealed, you know, for most of the book, people are having relationships without this secret being out. And I was wondering about, could people forgive themselves and move forward in their lives without necessarily bringing that out? Because one of my thoughts was, I bet people do this all the time.
I'm sure they do it all the time. And I think that forgiveness doesn't mean that you let yourself off the hook. I mean, my friend, she admitted, I did this at the time. I wanted to do it. I've spent the rest of my life trying to be a good person to overrule that. I mean, it's not like saying, when you forgive yourself, it's not like saying, well, I had changed my mind about what I did. It wasn't so bad after all. It was okay. I needed to do it. You still get to feel grief over it and get to feel bad about it, but it just means now you're going to have agency, so you're going to go out and take action to be a better person and to be kinder to other people. And if you do it right, you become more compassionate, I think. When you've done something bad in your life, as we all have, but when you've done something bad, I think you have a choice. You can get bitter and withdrawn, or you can be more compassionate and get more kind to other people. And I think the trick is to go for the compassion and the kindness, and to recognize that, you know, we're all bad and good at the same thing, and we have to sort of embrace both of it. But no, you don't have to tell people. Do they need to know? I mean, does everybody need to know that woman had killed somebody when it happened a million years ago and she had changed herself? Why would they need to know that? Mm-hmm. Other than a mistaken idea that, well, we'll be closer about it.
Right.
I mean, I knew about it. I knew about it, and I can't say it made me less close, and I can't say it made me more close. It was just like listening to something that happened to a different person that just happened to be my friend.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good point, is you don't know that person.
Yeah, you don't know that person. That's right. It's a different version.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And we all can change. We all have the capacity to change. And we don't, you know, we don't know if people would stay the same.
Well, and one of the things that there's a connection to the parent-child, where the parent decides what to tell.
Right.
Thinking about protecting their child.
Right.
Maybe with some parents in the book, I don't know if they're protecting their child so much as maybe themselves, but I'm going to leave that for readers. But, but I think that's another aspect of it, as like, I'll do anything for my child. How far does that go? And does that mean to save your own child?
That's right. And what does it do to your own life? Yeah. It's like, secrets always boomerang. It's just, it's terrible. It's a really thorny issue. And I don't know if there's a cut and dried answer to that. It depends on the secret, and it depends on who's going to get hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that's so lovely about your book, is the parents are so very human without being judged about making decisions for
For their kids.
For their kids, or think they're making the right decision for their kids, and then later paying for that.
Right, right.
In the relationship, like it like I'm going to make this choice for you, and if you come to find out about it, you won't talk. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Whoa, right. Whoa. Yeah. This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. If you enjoy Between the Covers interviews and our other programs, please donate to KBOO now during our end of the year campaign. Your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of KBOO donors. Thanks as always for your support. In your acknowledgments, you did make it clear. You did a lot of legal research. That was one of the nerd factors I adored, was it made me think about like, oh, how, which fascinating question did you go and talk to lawyers about? Because there's so many issues here.
There's so many issues.
Anyway,
well, I was lucky because a lot of times when I reached out to the lawyers, they were just, a lot of them were like matter of fact. They would say, well, no, that would never happen. She'd never go to a woman's prison. She'd go here and that. So I called my first husband up, who is an attorney, and he was so great because I said, look, I need the law to fit my plot. And he said, oh, okay, let's see how we can do this. And we had long conversations, and it was so great because I would say, could this say, I need this to happen. How could this happen? And he would have all these great, rich stories for me so I could use this. And it was the same thing where I had to find out, my first husband practices, he's in Florida, so I needed somebody in New York. So I found this great guy, Peter Barter, who's a DA in Queens, actually, I believe. And I did the same thing. I said, Peter, this has to fit my plot. Because originally he said like, oh no, this would happen, then this would happen. And I said, no, I needed to screw up. You know, I needed to screw up so that years later, someone is going to say, this case was not handled properly. Tell me what to do.
Oh, how do they do it when they do it badly?
It was so helpful and so great. And he was so funny. And he offered to take me to an arraignment. And he said, oh, well, you know, judges are this and all this insider stuff that I never would have gotten from books or anything else. And it was fascinating. It was just, that's the thing that I love. I love research because you get to learn.
Yeah.
You get to learn all these weird things. And I learned that, you know, never sit in a room with cops without your lawyer present. Never, never, ever. Never sign anything. If you're tired, don't say anything. When you're arraigned.
Miranda can be done in a way that's...
Yeah, in a different way. Do not say anything when you're arraigned, like not a word. Because that'll be held against. I mean, so I have this whole list of useful life things that I could use if I need to. But it was fascinating. It was totally fascinating.
Well, I mean, you've got this like such a naive character dealing with
life. Right. Plus,
yeah. A little, you know, a young, terrified girl, and
yeah.
So it's so easy to watch how other people's agendas fill that space. So that connects to my next question, is the other fascinating dimension about it is that some characters have actual memory gaps of the event.
Yes. Yes. This is like, that was another thing. Cause I wanted, first I thought, well, maybe they're taking drugs and acid. And I thought, no, nah, that's too easy to dispute. Plus that's not always a reason not to remember. And they'd find the drugs and that would be another thing. So I started researching and I thought, oh, you know what? I just remembered when I was a kid, I didn't sleep because I was afraid of the dark or afraid of whatever. And after a while, I started to hallucinate when I was in college, and it would be the weirdest thing. I would sleepwalk and I would hallucinate. And I thought, of course, they're being separated. They're kids. They would think it would be very romantic if they tried to stay awake and they just didn't sleep. And you know, so it's like things got really hazy and they were missing each other. I must have written that part like 8,000 times because it was so hard to figure out. And again, I found another great guy who worked at an ER, and I was asking him about that. Like, what would cause a gap in memory, if it wasn't drugs, and what do you do about it, and what's the effects of not sleeping, and can you really stop yourself from sleeping? And he gave me all this great stuff. It was amazing. It was really interesting and fun.
Well, it's such a great part of the story because you're talking about someone feeling guilt about something they don't remember
doing.
That's a fascinating.
Well, memory is weird. I mean, if you think back to it's, I mean, they've done experiments where in college classes where somebody will come in and grab something from a teacher and push them. And then they'll ask everybody, what did you see? And people see different things. And also as you get older and you go through life, sometimes you remember certain things will pop up and you think, oh, I thought it was that, but it actually wasn't. I mean, memory can trick you all the time, depending on what you want to believe and what you really believe.
Mm-hmm. And Ella had to wrestle with it in a way.
Yeah.
More than other people, let's just say, in a particular way, but she had to go on with her life. Like I was thinking about like her when she gets out of prison and wants to start her own life. Like, how does this carry, you know, how does she carry this around? Where she feels guilty about something that someone that she doesn't remember doing.
Right.
And I was thinking about like, how do you fill in that blank space inside of yourself?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I just assumed that, you know, there's a variety of ways that you could do it. I guess you could just say, okay, I'm not going to think about it and compartmentalize it. Or you could, you know, I don't know. I used to, when I've forgotten things, I once went to a hypnotist, but they can make you think you're remembering when you're really not. It's not as if her problem was there's nobody she could really ask. You know, because nobody's going to tell her the truth and the court records weren't the truth. So for her, the truth had to sort of bubble up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So towards the end, she could sort of remember.
So she has this gray kind of thing that she,
right,
or it bubbles up in most of her years when we get to know her between 15 and 22 or whatever. She has to get through the pregnancy and then that's the focus of everything. But what I was wondering is that in the last time I talked to you, and we were talking about your last book where this woman goes into a coma and remembers everything. when you and I talked about it, you said I was in a coma and I didn't remember anything.
I don't remember anything. You know what? That's a really good question because you just made me realize something that I didn't even think of that when I was running this book, but it's the same thing. I'm still living with the fact that I don't remember. I really don't remember a lot what's happening and nobody really wants to still talk about it. And so the only versions I had to go on were, you know, the versions that the doctors told me, and they all, of course, like were saying like, well, I did this and I did this, or what my friends would tell me, but they were also freaked out. But I kept thinking, well, what was it really like? I mean, I just don't remember. Mm-hmm. And I've thought about going to hypnotist, except I'm afraid that it's not going to be pleasant if I go. Plus, how could you know if that was true or not? I mean,
it's such a good point that you're making that, you know, it's not like it can just go into a file cabinet and be brought forward. It's formed by where you are when you're trying to bring it back. But so when I think about it with Ella never having, I did this, just all they had. And I think it was lovely the way that you talked about it as what we knew was that a character was getting in their way of being together and they were so angry about it. And that's it. That's all she remembers.
Yeah. And also that, you know, I'd do anything for you. I mean, that's 15. Right. That's 15.
Yeah. So I thought of you about your last book when you wrote about like that kind of sleep deprived night and this kind of flashes of, I remember this first, I was here, then I was here. And he says, you know, I was there, but yeah. I mean, it's so well done. I was just like, It's great. But I thought there's a way that you have this kind of unspoken knowledge of a kind of a blank space.
I do. And I guess I haven't really come to terms with it yet because I don't know how to. I mean, I went to therapy and the consensus is always, well, it is what it is. And there's, you know, what are you going to do? You can't time travel back and figure out what it was like. And maybe it's better that you don't know what it's like. I mean, there was a reason why they gave me memory blockers. And maybe that was the reason. I mean, who knows?
But so, I think it's also present in the book. It gives you the question that was so lovely is, is it easier for Ella not to remember?
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's really, really astute. That's right. It's easier not to remember. But in her case, the thing she needs to remember is going to help her. But you're right. It's easier for people not to remember sometimes.
Yeah. So again, all amazing elements that fuse together to sort of give it momentum and suspense. And it was delightful. So which of the relationships then, because there's so many and so complex, which relationship was the biggest leap for you to imagine in the book?
Oh, I think it was with, well, you know, I was crazy at 15 in love. So that I knew about.
You had that one.
You know, my mother fell in love very late in life, which was lovely to see. So that was easy to do. I think the hardest thing was that, you know, I have a son, so I know what it's like to be in love with a child. But I never, you know, at one point after I had Max, I couldn't have any more kids biologically. So we were going to adopt. And I remember how strange it was for us because I was always really worried about the birth mothers who I would speak to and what they thought of me and what they thought of Jeff and did they think I'd be a good mother and how was I supposed to act with them? And in the end, we got scammed once and then we weren't chosen. And at that point, I was so freaked out. I said, let's just be grateful for what we have. But when I was writing Ella, going back to find her child, it was the same thing where I kept saying, she can't take this child away from her mother because I'm a mother. I was that mother. And that's a horrible thing to do. But I said, on the other hand, she can't let the child alone because it's her child biologically. So that was really difficult for me to do. I had to sort of figure out like, well, what kind of a relationship would she have? And I had to figure out how you can love somebody else's child in a way that would make sense in the book. So that was a new thing for me. And I ended up figuring it out as best that I could.
So it was Ella's relationship to Carla.
Right, Ella's relationship to Carla. I mean, that's her biological child, but it's not her daughter. Carla belongs to Mariana, her adoptive mother.
And that's another whole dimension of the tension of the secret is every scene with Mariana.
Oh yeah.
Ella in it where Mariana doesn't know and
right.
Wow. I mean, you could have like written the next book in the next book. Characters are amazing.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. A reminder, KBOO's in the middle of our annual end of the year membership drive. It's that time of year where KBOO is in stitches over this end of the year membership drive, and we need you to embroider the airwaves with your monthly sustaining gift. KBOO's commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Please help us reach our $70,000 goal and sew the record player needle with your gift. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And thank you.
Can you talk about how, again, back to sort of writer nerdy thing, how you mapped out time so beautifully? Because you worked two timelines.
It was a nightmare. I actually had to hire somebody to help me. I'm serious. I paid somebody to help me on that because I couldn't figure it out. First, I've never done two dual timelines. I usually do it, you know, you have your main things going forward and then they remember stuff. And I thought, I can't do it with this book because the backstory is as interesting to me as the front story. So first I wrote out all the scenes on note cards, all of them in one color that were the backstory. Like, was this happening? Ella falls in love, blah, 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 blah. And then I wrote all the present day scenes, which were going to start with when Ella's leaving prison. And those were all the present day scenes. So then once I worked those out, so they figured right, I thought, well, where the hell are they going to mesh? And I didn't know how to do that at all. I was totally stunned. I talked to a lot of writers and I said, how do you do that? And they said, well, you know, if you want to end one chapter in the past happy, you might want to start the next chapter in the present unhappy. Or, I mean, I didn't know how to do it. So I actually hired somebody to help me and it took us about 3 months to figure it out. I mean, she would help me and I would have to go back and say, wait a minute, it's like I had to be careful that what I put in the past wasn't information that somebody in the present was going to know. I mean, I didn't want the reader to know anything that would have been given away. And actually, after I hired one person, then I had a really great editor at Algonquin, and he went through it again with me. So we had to fix it up again because some things were too fast. They didn't happen in the right place because you want the momentum to keep going, da, 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 da. And you don't want it to go, which mine was doing. So it was hard. I mean, because every time I changed something, I would have to change seasons and years. And I had a million calendars around. It's really, really hard to do. And I really don't want to do that ever again. Or at least I say that now.
More than the two timelines, or did you write all, you wrote all the way through?
I wrote the two timelines separately. Here's the whole past. Here's the whole present. Then I broke it up into scenes. And then I had to figure, well, this scene should go here, or maybe it could go there, but I mean, it just had to have a momentum, and it was really hard. I'm a big supporter of, you know, hiring developmental editors to help you when you can't. I was literally sitting here with pages all over the place and I couldn't do it. I needed help.
I mean, I think that's really nice for other people to hear because
it
reads like you were just like,
oh No. It's real. The whole thing is, I love being a writer. I love writing, but it is so hard. And, you know, you shouldn't be ashamed to ask people questions or to ask for help or to recognize that there might be 24 drafts before you have the story. And that's okay. That's part of the work.
So developmental editors are people that you've taken your story as far as you can, but you can't, you know, it...
I can't do anymore because I'm too close to it. I usually will do 6 drafts, no fooling. Yeah. And then I look at it and I say, I know something's off, but I don't know what it is. And then I will show it to, I have 2 writer friends I share stuff to, and they always have comments. And then I fix it up, but I still know there's something not right. So then I will hire a developmental writer, a developmental editor, and what they do is they go through and they look at the big picture and the structure, and they will say things like, there was a lot of questions before I got, like, why do the memory blocks? I think I originally had it that they were, I'm not sure what they were doing at first. I think maybe I did have them, drugs. Right. And the developmental editor said, that's not really, I'm not believing that because this would happen and that. You have to think of something else. Or they would say, you know, you didn't really develop this relationship between Helen and Miles. What do they do? Do they go out? Do they talk to each other? Do they argue? What do they argue? I mean, there's all these kinds of questions that I wouldn't have thought of. And then it gave me ideas. And I thought, oh, yes, exactly right. Now I know how to rewrite. And you just go back and forth and back and forth. And then you have a Zoom talk where they say, yes, I like this, but why did you do such and such? And it's just about digging deeper and putting more layers on so that the story becomes richer and better and more about, and so that it's not just the story about people. It's a story about, you know, ideas, you know, like, how are you forgiven? Mm-hmm. What secrets do you keep? What does it mean to, do you always love the person you had, you loved when you were 15, and why not? And how, what does it mean to be a good mother? And what, it's just incredibly, incredibly helpful. And I never hired developmental editors until about 3 years ago. And now I'm always going to do it. I'm always going to start socking away my money because it's expensive. It's not cheap. Yeah. If you go to a good one, but it's so worth it. It's so worth it.
That's fascinating because in some ways I just think, you know, in the publishing business, that's what your editor does. And I'm just wondering if it's one of the things that you've sort of seen over time that it seems like writers say they're kind of supposed to have their book pre-edited before they present it.
Well, I don't, I've heard from writer friends of mine that, you know, they have agents who don't edit. I mean, my agent edits, which is great. And some editors don't really edit. And I've had editors who don't edit. My editor now is, he's fantastic. I mean, he edited my book 3 times, then said, let's do it again. Do you mind doing it again? I said, no, 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 that's great. That's great. But at the same point, I wanted to give him the best possible book I could before he started his editing. So that's why I did that. And that's why I'll continue to do that. And I don't, you know, I don't think there's any shame in doing that. To me, it's like, I want it to be the best it can be. You know, and publishing at its best should be collaborative. That's when it's the most fun.
Yeah, I think you're a really strong voice for that. So coming back to what you were saying about, so the bigger thing we want in writing is to have the book be about ideas. And it does seem like the main, one of the main ideas in your book is about forgiveness and self-forgiveness.
Yeah.
What do you think allowed self-forgiveness in all of your characters?
All of my characters face, I mean, I make them face what they did wrong. I make them face the pain they've caused other people and the pain they're causing themselves until they, you know, there's something that's called the, some people call it the big doom. I call it the all's lost moment where you're just reached, but there's nothing you can do. You're at the very lowest point. And, but it's at that point where you can realize, okay, I can do something new. I can rise up and like proceed and move forward in the world and figure out how to do that. And that's sort of what I do for them. It's not that they're, it's not that Ella or any of the characters are going to be these shiny, perfect people anymore. They're not. They've had bad things in their past, but it's almost like, okay, well, here we are in the now, and what we do now is more important. And hopefully what happened before, I try to make it make my characters a little more compassionate or a little more understanding or a little more able to let go of things that they so desperately wanted that they can't have. I mean, Helen cannot go back and live in a Hasidic community. She can't. There's no way they would want her, and there's no way she would really, with what she knows now, there's probably no way she would want to, but you know, you can't, you have to move on.
Well, I think it's one of the interesting things in the book. You have these moments where someone does try to go back.
Right.
In a certain way. And the way it falls apart really brings
that,
that wish and that just
I always try to go back myself, but it never works.
That's all my questions.
You ask such great questions. I mean, you did last time and this time too. It's interesting to me because I'm just so used to this book that I don't even know what to ask myself about it. But you brought up such great points and thank you so, so much. And I love talking to you and I really appreciate this.
Are you already working on the next one?
I finished it. I just gave it to my agent.
I love it.
I know. It's called The Inseparables, and it's about these two college-age women friends who are just inseparable. And then one of them betrays the other one with this guy, and there's a child, and it just follows them through life. And it's about, I guess I haven't figured that. It's about like secrets, secrets and lies. And it's also actually about mental health, You know, it's like how mental health can derail stuff. Again, it involved a lot of really interesting research.
How did you, what was your origin moment?
My origin story? Two things. When I left my first marriage and I moved to New York, I was really young. I was a baby. And I lived in this tiny little studio in New York. I didn't know anybody. And right across the hall from me, there was this woman who was this beautiful, flamboyant, incredible woman. And we became fast friends. And she was so brave. She made me brave. And we were literally inseparable. She had a boyfriend. I had a boyfriend. We always did stuff together. But it was something that I wanted to write about because she was so, so important to my life. And she changed my life for the better. And she was amazing. And also just, you know, where she is now. I sort of wanted to write about that in the context of friendship and what happens to people with that. So that was that.
So again, you get all this inspiration from
That's why I tell you.
Then you create.
You want to know me? Go read my books.
I do want to know you. And I read every book you write.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Spend time with you. And thank you for being on the show.
I love being on the show. Please send me a link when it's running and I'll put it everywhere.
Thanks for listening. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, show your support for this program and all your favorite KBOO programs by donating to KBOO's end of the year membership drive today at kboo.fm/give. KBOO's community supported and community focused radio, bringing you voices from your community.
Maybe it's the wind blowing in the rain.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Original music from Karen Talumi.
Hiding in the clouds, I don't know why. I hear you crying out loud.